Today we're going to finish chapter 6 of Exodus and just touch on the beginning of chapter 7. I've called today's lesson the preamble to round 2. You may remember we've already studied one round, which was the first time that Moses went and confronted Pharaoh with the command of the Lord, let my people go. It didn't go well. And now we're coming up to the beginning of round 2. When David brought the Ark of the Covenant back to Jerusalem, Asaph the Levite proclaimed these words, "Give thanks to Yahweh, call upon His name, make known His deeds among the people. Sing to Him, sing praises to Him, speak of all His wonders, glory in His holy name. Let the heart of those who seek Yahweh be glad." In the opening verses of chapter 6 of Exodus, God revealed some new information about His name to the people and to Moses. It's information that soon is going to be made apparent to the Egyptians and specifically to Pharaoh through certain acts that God's going to perform. This new revelation is that Yahweh's about to act in a new way, in a way that will cause Israel and Egypt to see and to know that it is He who is the living God. The importance of the name Yahweh to this section of Exodus is emphasized because it appears 4 times in the phrase, "I am Yahweh," in the first part of this chapter. Yahweh says this of Himself in verse 2, in verse 6, in verse 7, and in verse 8. So, "I am Yahweh" becomes the basic formula by which God identifies Himself through an act of self-revelation. This self-revealing act that God's going to perform will be the mighty hand by which He will inflict judgment on Egypt and on Pharaoh, specifically through the plagues, through the release of Israel from bondage, and through the deliverance through the Red Sea. When He revealed His name to Moses, He wasn't just revealing His name in the sense of a label, but it was a revelation of His essential character, for in the divine name of Yahweh is encompassed the whole of the redemptive power of God. Last week we looked at the 20th chapter of Ezekiel. In verse 5 of that chapter, Ezekiel talks about the revelation of God's name to His people as a solemn oath, by which He's committed Himself to be their God. The new content that's being revealed about the name of God is made plain when it's contrasted with what the patriarchs thought about Yahweh. Yahweh has identified Himself as the selfsame God who spoke and made Himself known to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. And the reference in verse 3 of chapter 6 to El Shaddai is designed to call our attention back to Genesis 17 and the covenant between Yahweh and the patriarch Abraham. Then last week we looked at verse 4, where He goes on to reiterate the promise of the land, which was an essential part of the elements of the Abrahamic covenant and the promises that God made to Abraham. So while there's this definite connection back to the patriarchs, there's at the same time this decisive contrast, because a new aspect of God's name is about to be revealed, and it's a new aspect that moves Israel from the realm of covenant promises to the realm of covenant fulfillment. The message that Moses is commanded to announce yet again to Pharaoh and to the people begins and ends with this phrase, "I am Yahweh." It becomes the Alpha and Omega, if you will, of God's Old Testament revelation of Himself to His people. It's a name and a phrase that brackets the message that Moses is going to give regarding Israel. It emphasizes certainly the deliverance of Israel from bondage in Egypt. It's a redemption act. It's an act of redemption through which He will accomplish through an outstretched arm. But there's also the idea that Israel is being adopted into the covenant. In chapter 6, verse 7, God says, "I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God. And then finally, there's the granting of the land promise to Israel, which was sworn to Abraham. Then last week, we looked at verse 9. And we know that Moses went back after he had this conversation with the Lord, and he reemphasized to Israel what God was going to do, but the people didn't listen to him. The text literally says that they didn't listen because of a shortness of spirit. I think the King James may say anguish of spirit. The NIV says because they were discouraged, but the text really says because of a shortness of spirit. They had an emotional short fuse based on the hard labor that they've been forced to endure and based on the response that Pharaoh gave to Moses' request. Now, when we get to the chapter and the verses that we're going to look at today, we're going to find that the flow of the passage is interrupted somewhat by a genealogy that just suddenly appears right in the middle of a conversation. So I'm going to be commenting on the genealogy toward the end of the lesson. But what I want to do to just try to establish some continuity here in the beginning is when we do our scripture reading, I'm going to be reading chapter 6, verses 10 through 13. Then I'm going to skip and read chapter 6, verses 28 through 7-7. I'll come back and read the section selectively regarding the genealogy after that. So let's begin today, chapter 6, verse 10. Now Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, "Go tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the sons of Israel go out of the land." But Moses spoke before Yahweh, saying, "Behold, the sons of Israel have not listened to me. How then will Pharaoh listen to me, for I am unskilled in speech?" Then the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, and he gave them a charge to the sons of Israel and to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt. Now, if you will, skip down to verse 28. Now, it came about on the day when the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, that the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "I am Yahweh. Speak to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I speak to you." But Moses said before the Lord, "Behold, I'm unskilled in speech. How then shall I go to Pharaoh? He won't listen to me." Then the Lord said to Moses, "See, I make you as a god to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you, and your brother Aaron shall speak to Pharaoh that he let the sons of Israel go out of the land. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, that I may multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt. When Pharaoh will not listen to you, then I'll lay my hand on Egypt and bring out my hosts, my people, the sons of Israel, from the land of Egypt with great judgments. The Egyptians shall know that I am Yahweh when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the sons of Israel from their midst." So Moses and Aaron did as the Lord commanded them. Thus they did. Moses was 80 years old, and Aaron was 83 when they spoke before Pharaoh. If I were trying to put a title on those first four verses, verses 10 through 13, I think a good one might be, "Oh no, not again." Because I can't think of any words that God could have spoken to Moses that Moses would hate to hear more than the words commanding him to go back to Pharaoh again, where he's had such a terrible experience in the beginning. After the failure of round one, Moses had already gone back to the Lord, and he obeyed the Lord, and he went back to the people, and he promised them that God was going to deliver them from bondage. But they refused to listen to him. They didn't hear him. They didn't pay attention. So now what Moses is being asked to do is to go back to Pharaoh after the people have already rejected his word and make the same demand again. And Moses, you may remember, this never did start out too well for Moses in the first place. Moses always had doubts. Those doubts, at least in the beginning, were hypothetical. They've now been more or less confirmed to him. They're very concrete to Moses right now. He feared that Pharaoh wouldn't listen to him, and sure enough, Pharaoh didn't. So he comes back to the Lord, and he says, I am of uncircumcised lips. That's what the Hebrew text says that is translated unskilled of speech. He says, I am uncircumcised of lips, and he says it two times. If the people won't listen to me, what makes you think Pharaoh will? Well, God responds to this complaint. If the people won't listen, what makes you think Pharaoh will listen to me? He responds to that a very interesting way down in chapter 7, verse 3. Here's what God says. He says, you know what, Moses? You're right. Pharaoh will not listen to you. In fact, I'm going to harden his heart so that he won't listen. And Moses has got to be thinking, what? You're sending me back? I've just complained that he won't listen, and you're confirming that I'm right. And in fact, you're going to harden his heart so that he won't listen to me? What in the world's going on here? Now, we've talked just a little bit about this phrase, the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, in the past. I want to talk about it a little bit more today and just raise the basic question, what does this mean when the text says that God is going to harden Pharaoh's heart? And I want to begin by looking at two points. The first one is this. When we read this story of the Exodus, we have to keep in mind that God is doing more than one thing here. This is not just a story about liberating the Israelite slaves. That's part of it. The Exodus is not just about liberating victims. If you try to think of the Exodus as just liberating victims, you'll come to some false conclusions about what's really happening here. That's the first point to remember. God is going to deliver his people from bondage. But that's not all he's doing. He's also going to judge Egypt. He's going to use Israel as a tool to do that. This was already given as a prophecy back in Genesis 15 to Abraham. Back in that chapter, God said to Abraham, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land, that is in Egypt, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. But I also will judge the nation whom they will serve afterward, and they'll come out with great possessions. So God has already told back in the days of Abraham that, yes, you're going to be put into bondage, but when I release you, I'm also going to judge that nation that put you in bondage. So that's very important to understand in this context of Pharaoh's hard heart. While God is liberating his people, he's giving Pharaoh an opportunity to pile coals of judgment, if you will, on his head for the judgment that's coming on the basis of his disobedience. And later, there's a third thing that's going to happen. God's going to judge the Canaanites. He's already said to Abraham that you're going to go down into bondage because the iniquity of the Amalekites, the Canaanites, is not yet complete. So there are at least three things going on here that have to be seen in context. You have the deliverance from bondage, you have the judgment on the nation of Israel, and you have the upcoming judgment on the Canaanites in the land of Canaan. Anytime you try to separate any of these three and see them outside the context of the whole, you'll come to false conclusions. This is where you start to see such things as the conquest deemed genocide. It's when you don't understand it in the broader context of what's happening. So the first point here is that God is doing three things. He's delivering his people, he's judging Egypt, and he's going to judge the Canaanites. Now, the second point that I want to make about this is more theological in nature. And it's this. God is exercising his prerogative as the sovereign God of the universe to execute his eternal plan however he so chooses to do so. When I was a student at DTS, I took a class from S. Lewis Johnson called The Use of the Old Testament by the New Testament. I'll never forget what he said to us the first day of class that semester. He stood up and he said, men, now there were no women there then, so he said, men, in order to earn a passing grade in this class, you must have an above average facility in Greek, Hebrew, and Aramaic. Now, we will now observe a moment of silence while most of you gather your possessions, stand up, make your way to the registrar's office, and drop this class. That's just one of those things that never leaves you. For those of us who stayed the course, it was a fascinating study with a great Bible teacher and a great scholar and a great man. He taught us that when we study the Bible, it's very important to understand how the Old Testament and the New Testament are related and to see the importance of making connections between the two. How to see the Old Testament scriptures and the theology that is later developed in the New Testament, how that fits together, how it all makes sense. Sometimes the New Testament will elucidate something that was not clear in the Old Testament. Sometimes you can go back to an Old Testament passage and it will illuminate something that was a bit vague in the New Testament. But they need to be seen as a whole. So it's important, I think, as we try to deal with a difficult theological concept like God hardening the heart of Pharaoh, to think about the context of both the Old and the New Testament. I like to always go to a source that I know we all trust, and that's the New Testament, when we run into something this difficult in the Old Testament. So I want to mention Paul's commentary on the subject of the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. Romans 9 through 11, three chapters. In those three chapters, Paul's answering the questions, what about Israel? Has God turned his back on his chosen people? And it just so happens I took the book of Romans from S.L. Johnson too, so it was a good way to see how all of this was fit together in his own mind. You can take the book of Romans and you can read chapters 1 through 8, and then you can skip to chapter 12 and it'll read just fine. The only thing you'll miss is Paul's treatment of this extremely difficult but interesting topic. As part of his handling this broader concept of what is going on with Israel in the church age, Paul cites in verses 12 and 13 of Romans 9, Malachi 1, verses 2 and 3. That's the verse that says, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. He also quotes Genesis 25, 23, the older shall serve the younger, out of the midst of that Jacob-Esau story, because that's the passage on which Malachi's comments are based. Paul goes on in verse 15 of Romans 9 to quote Exodus 33:19. There he says, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I'll have compassion on whom I'll have compassion. There he's quoting Exodus and Moses. Paul then moves in support of his conclusion that salvation does not depend on the man who wills or the man who runs, but on God who shows mercy. To use the example of Pharaoh, this very example that we're talking about in Exodus 6. In Romans 9:17, listen to what Paul says, because this is his commentary on this. He says, for this very purpose I raised you up, to demonstrate my power in you, that my name might be proclaimed throughout the whole earth. He then concludes verse 18 of Romans chapter 9 by saying, so then, he has mercy on whom he desires, and he hardens whom he desires. What follows that statement are verses 21 through 24, where Paul uses the potter and clay metaphor. In this metaphor, he makes the point that the potter has complete authority over the clay to make a vessel to show his mercy and glory, while at the same time having every right to fashion another vessel as a way of expressing his wrath. This is Paul. This is Paul's commentary on Exodus 6. This is the kind of vessel Pharaoh was. You see, Paul didn't just make up the doctrine of election. He knew the Old Testament. He knew the book of Genesis. He knew the book of Exodus. He knew Israel's history. He knew how God had worked through things in Israel's past, through nations like Egypt, through people like Pharaoh. One of the things that I hope has been impressive in terms of the way theology has developed since we started our study nearly 2.5 years ago in Genesis, is that this concept of God's sovereignty is not just occasionally mentioned in the Bible. It runs through and through the Old Testament. It is in Genesis. It runs through Exodus. And the doctrine of sovereign electing grace is certainly taught more explicitly in the New Testament, but it's laid out for us in the Old Testament as well. And in fact, the Old Testament becomes some of the primary texts that Paul uses in the New Testament to more fully develop this point. Well, there's a point that's sometimes overlooked in reading Romans 9. And it's a divine attribute that has to do with the way God judges evil. God's characterized by Paul as dealing with evil very patiently. He said in verse 22 of chapter 9, God endured with much patience the rebellion of Pharaoh prior to executing judgment on him. God dealt with Pharaoh patiently. God didn't need to warn Pharaoh over and over that he was going to judge him. But he did it no less than 10 times. He gave Pharaoh every opportunity to be obedient. But Pharaoh showed himself completely obstinate to God. And this brought final judgment on Pharaoh. And Paul was then able to say that because of God's patience in his dealing with Pharaoh, Pharaoh was without excuse. And there's another point I want to make about this idea of hardening the heart. The phrase occurs 10 times in the book of Exodus. Sometimes we read, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. Sometimes we read, Pharaoh hardened his own heart. And sometimes we simply read, his heart was hardened. How should we understand these, and what's the distinction among the three? It shouldn't come as a surprise. There are many who would like to interpret the phrase, I will harden Pharaoh's heart, by pointing to the phrase, Pharaoh hardened his own heart. The theology then becomes, God allowed Pharaoh to harden his own heart. But it just so happens, in the science of biblical interpretation, there's a principle. It's a principle known as the principle of first occurrence. The principle of first occurrence. This principle puts a special emphasis on the first occurrence of a word or a phrase or a theological concept or a doctrine as being primary. Listen to what A.T. Pearson said about the principle of first occurrence. Here's what he said. He said, this is a law long since noted and have never yet found it to fail. And here it is. The first occurrence of a word, expression, or utterance is the key to its subsequent meaning, and it will be a guide to ascertaining the essential truth connected with it. Let me read that again. This is the law or principle of first occurrence. The first occurrence of a word or an expression or an utterance is the key to its subsequent meaning, or it will be a guide to ascertaining the essential truth connected to it. Let's think about some examples. Does anyone know the first recorded words of Jesus? Ever thought about that? Remember the story when he came to Jerusalem with his family when he was a boy? And they had been to the feast there, and they were on their way home, and Mary thought Jesus was with Joseph, and Joseph thought Jesus was with Mary, and they got a day or so down the road, and I guess they had that conversation. Well, I thought he was with you. Well, no, I thought he was with you. And they became afraid for his safety, of course, so they turned around and went back to Jerusalem, and they found him in the temple talking to the scholars of his day. Here are the first recorded words of Jesus when confronted by his parents. He said, did you not know that I must be about my Father's business? Those are the first recorded words of Jesus. He spoke those words when he was 12 years old. And his first recorded words were indicative of his ministry. until on the cross he says it's finished. He's finished his Father's business. So the first occurrence of this phrase, "Did you not know I must be about my Father's business," defined his ministry. And some of his last words actually wraps up what he said when he was 12 years old. The principle of first occurrence. The first occurrence of the word faith in the Bible is in Genesis 15:6. "And Abraham believed in Yahweh, and it was accounted unto him as righteousness." The first occurrence of the word faith. It becomes a fundamental principle on which our concept of salvation through faith alone is based. And that's the first occurrence. In our passage today, we have the first occurrence in the Bible of the word prophet. And in the definition of a prophet, which we're going to see in chapter 7, it becomes a foundation stone for the office of prophet, which is going to become so important in the nation of Israel through the life and history of that nation. So this is what the principle of first occurrence means. So if we're going to understand this phrase, "I will harden Pharaoh's heart," Pharaoh will harden his own heart. Pharaoh's heart is hardened. We need to go back and we need to look at first occurrences. The first occurrence of the phrase is in chapter 4, verse 21. Here it is. "Yahweh said to Moses, when you go back to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders which I put in your power. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go." The second occurrence of this phrase is in chapter 7, verse 3. "But I will harden Pharaoh's heart that I may multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt." So the first and the second occurrence of the phrase really leave very little to the imagination. God, by his own sovereign choice, will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will not let Israel go. Now, certainly, Pharaoh's going to harden his own heart, because when the natural man acts in accordance with his own nature, a nature which the Bible teaches us is God's enemy, the result will be that he will harden his heart. But the process begins with a sovereign, elective decree, which Paul again quotes in Romans, "For this very purpose I raised you up to demonstrate my power in you, that my name may be proclaimed throughout the earth." Now, we're going to talk about this some more over time, but I just want to mention a little bit about this phrase today, because it does occur in a significant passage in our verse. Skip down to verse 28, if you will. We're going to come back to the genealogy. "It came about on that day when the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt that the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, I am Yahweh, speak to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I spoke to you. But Moses said to the Lord, behold, I'm uncircumcised of tongue. How then will Pharaoh listen to me?" The genealogy has interrupted the flow. What you have in those verses is really just a restoration of the flow of the narrative. The event that's referred to here is the same event that was referred to earlier in verses 10 through 13. So now we're into chapter 7. At this point in the chapter, if you think about Moses, you can only say that Moses at this point in his life is a complete failure. I think he would agree. It's easy to be obedient when obedient results in immediate success. But when your obedience doesn't result in immediate success, it's kind of tough. The best analogy I could think of would be maybe you're asked to sing a solo in front of a great audience. And you stand up and you sing and you're booed off the stage. How anxious would you be to follow that up with a second performance? This is what Moses is dealing with, except it's worse than that. Not only was Moses' performance dismal, and not only was he, in effect, booed off the stage, but what he did actually brought harm to his people. Now he's being told to go back to Pharaoh, to the scene of the failure, and to make the same demand that resulted in increased hardship for the nation. So how does God deal with this discouragement, this difficulty in Moses' life of obedience or disobedience? Well, it's really quite interesting. He says to Moses, I've made you a god to Pharaoh, and Aaron will be your prophet. In Exodus 4, verse 16, God had already said to him, you will be a god to Aaron. Remember that? Now he says, you'll be a god to Pharaoh. We have to understand, because this is our first occurrence here of the word prophet, what is going on here? What is the relationship that God first established between Moses and Aaron back in chapter 4? Well, it's this. Moses will speak the words that God gives him to Aaron, and then Aaron will speak those words to the people. 4:16 literally says, he, Aaron, will be to you as a mouth, and you will be unto him as an Elohim, as a God. You will be the sole source of what Aaron says. That's the relationship between a God and a prophet. The God is the sole source of what is said, and the prophet is the mouthpiece or the spokesman for the God. But when we get to chapter 7, the context is different. Both Moses and Aaron are going to be standing before Pharaoh. Pharaoh, if you'll remember, considers himself to be a god. So Yahweh is saying to Moses, you're going to be standing in front of someone who thinks he's a god, but you're going to be like a god to him. Now, if you go over to the Psalms, it's interesting what we read there in Psalm 135. The idols of the nations are but silver and gold, the work of man's hands. They have mouths, but they do not speak. They have eyes, but they don't see. They have ears, but they don't hear. And there's no breath at all in their mouth. So, though the false gods of Egypt may be depicted with mouths, they don't speak. They're unable to do anything. And we have here this man who considers himself to be a god, and yet he is a representative of false gods. Moses is going to stand in front of this man with the authority of the living God, and Aaron, his prophet, his spokesman, is going to speak to the man who thinks he's a god. The prophet speaks authoritatively because the words he speaks come from God. In 1 Corinthians 14:3, Paul talks about there to the Corinthians, he's comparing the value, relative value of the gift of tongues with the gift of prophecy. And he says there that a prophet speaks to men for edification and exhortation and comfort. But what Paul doesn't say in that phrase is just speaking edifying words or comforting words does not make a person a prophet. For a person to be a prophet, that prophet must receive new revelation from God, and he must speak with the authority that the words of God give him. So it's interesting, if not somewhat humorous, when you think about this in the context of Egypt, that you may recall a few weeks ago I said that pharaohs have multiple titles, one of which is son of Re, the sun god. One is Neter-Nefer, the perfect god. The pharaoh saw himself as the incarnation of the falcon god Horus, so he sees himself as a god. But Aaron's going to stand and speak to Pharaoh the words of Moses, whom God has declared to be like a god to Pharaoh. In other words, here we have two men, Pharaoh and Moses. Neither one of them is actually a god. One of them has been given the authority by the living God to speak with authority. The other person who thinks he's a god has no authority at all. So Moses is going to speak to Pharaoh through the mouth of Aaron. But according to verse 3, when he speaks to Pharaoh, God is going to harden the heart of the king so that he won't accept the words which Moses is giving to him. It sets in place this cycle. God will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will defy the Lord. Pharaoh will act in disobedience, which will further harden his own heart, the result of which will be his heart is hardened. This is what Paul's referring to in verse 17 of Romans 9 when he uses that phrase, "For this very reason I raised you up, to demonstrate my power in you, that my name might be proclaimed throughout the earth." Now, we have this little genealogy that rears its head in the middle of the narrative. What about the genealogy? Well, if you look at verse 14, the genealogy begins with the sons of Reuben. 14 says, "These are the heads of their father's households, the son of Reuben, Israel's firstborn." So we have the mention of the firstborn, Reuben. Then in verse 15, he says the sons of Simeon, and he lists those. That's Jacob's secondborn son. In verse 16, he says these are the names of the sons of Levi according to their generations. And the rest of the genealogy deals with the tribe of Levi. And the point of it is, why is this here? Well, it's giving a historical context for the personages who are involved in this this narrative, Aaron and Moses. It's tying them to the priestly tribe, the tribe of Levi. And then in verses 26 and 27, which are transitional, the genealogy is associating them back into the narrative. He says, "This is the same Aaron and Moses to whom the Lord said, 'Bring out the sons of Israel.'" And then verse 27, "They were the ones who spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, about bringing out the sons of Israel from Egypt, the same Moses and Aaron." It's kind of interesting if you look at the order there. He first mentions Aaron and Moses. That's because the emphasis there is on the genealogy, and Aaron's the firstborn. But when the shift goes to the mission that they're on, he puts Moses first because Moses is the one God has chosen to deliver Israel. I'm going to be using this genealogy in some detail as we go through the rest of the book. But now I just want to conclude with a couple of points that I think are important. The first part of our study in Exodus, the focus was really on the burning bush, the theophany, the revelation of God through the bush, and on the call of Moses. The bush episode and Moses' call has sort of faded into the background in chapters 6 and 7. The emphasis in these chapters is on God's self-revelation of himself through an act that is imminent. And that act is summarized in the phrase, "I am Yahweh." Because to know God's name, to know the name Yahweh, and to understand what God is going to do in his Yahweh character is to understand what he's going to do for Israel from beginning to end. And in fact, if you understand what God is revealing in his name, it gives you an understanding of all of redemptive history. Ezekiel, that we studied last week, carries this idea forward. He says that God's intervention into human history arises from his concern about the sanctity of his name. Ezekiel is arguing that there's nothing that happens in human history that shares the glory that belongs only to God. Pharaoh, in this story, is reduced to a pawn. He's a mere man who can't even control his own will. His will bends to the will of the living God. He's powerless. But when you get to the New Testament, it's there that you see the fullness of the idea of God's self-revelation. It is where this Old Testament theology really becomes real, because Paul appeals to Exodus in Romans 9, and it's not an accident that he does so. He says God has complete freedom to carry out his plan for Israel and for the nations, whether to make them objects of his mercy and glory or to make them objects of his wrath. The writer of Hebrews carries Ezekiel's premise further. He says the ultimate expression of God's self-revelation is in the revelation of his Son, Jesus Christ. The author of Hebrews writes this: "God, who at sundry times and in many diverse manners spoke in times past through the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us through his Son." But I think that it's the Gospel of John in its totality that really focuses on God's self-revelation through Christ. For John, the incarnation transcends history, and it completes all of past revelation. For him, Jesus is the light of the world that illuminates who God is to the world. God's mighty act of self-revelation through the Exodus and the deliverance of his people Israel, his judgment of evil as he brings this judgment on Pharaoh and on the Egyptians, and these things all point forward to the work of Christ, who has always been about his Father's business and who completed that business on the cross. Jesus Christ is the final revelation of God's name by which he makes himself known to the world. But what we see in the Old Testament is the beginning of these things. God is revealing himself to Israel, and he's going to reveal himself through mighty acts, and those mighty acts are going to begin taking place very, very quickly as Pharaoh continues to be obstinate and God's outstretched hands begins to bring the plagues to bear on the Egyptians. So there's really some pretty lofty theology in this, and we will be touching back on all of these points as we go on through the book. I wonder if there are any questions this morning.